We'll call a meeting to order. This is a State Government Finance Committee meeting for Wednesday, February 2nd, 2011. Happy Groundhog's Day, everyone.
Didn't see the shadow.
I hope you didn't see your shadow. Or maybe you did want to see your shadow. Whatever. We have a full agenda today. We still don't quite have a quorum, so we'll hold off on approving the minutes until we achieve a quorum. We're honored today to have our Secretary of State, the Honorable Mark Ritchie, give us a presentation on the operation of Secretary of State. So, Secretary Ritchie, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for this opportunity. I look forward to your questions and to our next presentation on the budget. But I want to thank all of you for the time that you've given me already, and I will continue to meet with other members to make sure that I'm spending as much time as I can with individual members to answer your questions and to provide more information. The Office of the Secretary of State has five big functions that we think about all the time. Facilitating commerce is by far our largest division. Elections, fair and open elections throughout the state. Civic education and engagement involving the citizens in our government is the way it's typically talked about. Being the keepers of our official documents and records and running the address confidentiality program for our state. This slide, next slide, summarizes the relative weight of our different divisions. Business services, over half, elections, our second largest. I'll talk a little bit more about these other areas as we go forward. The business services division takes a little bit over half of our staff, maybe about 60% depending on the month, time of the year. And the activity that's best known, I think, is business formations and annual reporting. Some of you have filed LLCs or form corporations or perhaps incorporated your church or some other organization. That's a major part of that particular piece of work. We're also the place for uniform commercial codes filings of lien records, whether it's on crops or livestock or tractors or things that move around. We are the central notification system for our UCC system in our state. We also are the registration point and record keeper on notaries, and we provide something called an apostille, which is primarily used for international trade and also international adoptions. Each year, we'll serve about a half a million people who make different kind of requests, different kind of filings. Sometimes they're just looking for information to see if a company that they might partner with or employ is in good standing. Sometimes they're doing filings. About 150,000 filings each year are the UCC type. In other words, they are noting a certain kind of lien and type of system. And we track about 2.3 million overall transactions and filings as we go forward. We get requests for certificates of good standing, about 600,000 of these requests come in through the mail, through email, in person. And we can only do this much work because we have excellent partners with our county recorders in many counties, also with the Office of Enterprise Technology and our vendors. We're a little unique in that this activity generates a surplus, a significant surplus from our point of view, to the general fund. We'll take in about $14 million a year, roughly. Your appropriation to us is about $6 million a year. $8 million a year, which is not $6 billion, I understand, but it is money for the general fund. We also know that companies have a choice. With the internet and with aggressive marketing by states like Delaware and others, people have a choice. And so we want to maintain the highest standard of customer service and stay in front of the technology so that those folks keep filing with us and so that money keeps going to the general fund. We've long had a kind of a steady rise, particularly in new business filings. Minnesota's a very active state. But something that we've noted in this latest economic period is a significant jump in our new business filings. The chart that you're seeing shows that in the last 4 years, we've been up about 57,000. The prior 4 years, we were at about 49,000. We actually had a spike of 64,000 new business creations, new entity filings in 2009, kind of the peak of the current difficulties. But in any case, these new filings are great news for the future for Minnesota. Often they take a little more time from our staff because they are fairly new and folks are asking a lot of questions, but they are a signal, and I was really pleased in discussions with Representative Mannion to see how he uses this data on a quarterly basis as one of the elements of the leading economic indicators in his region, and we want our data to be used like that more often and in other ways. So we're also thinking about how to make sure the digital availability of this data is simple and easy and inexpensive. I think you might have mentioned it costs $25 to get this data from our office. It's important data, but it's work for us, of course. It's work for us. We're always looking for efficiencies because our budget has been cut on kind of a regular basis or it's been reduced. We work very closely with Governor Pawlenty and Commissioner Hansen to develop voluntary reduction agreements in the past administration. Our office is constitutional and it's separate, so we work that out, and I think in a very good way. And then the legislature also has reduced our budget. So we're operating with about a little, about 69 full-time equivalents now, with 7 open positions unfilled because we have not had the funds because of the reductions. So we have learned how to handle some of those reductions without reducing the quality of our service by using technology and automation. And our office could provide a number of specific examples that might be of interest to the committee, but the one that's the most fun for me is John Deere, just because I'm mostly a farm guy, and that's kind of what I do. But John Deere is by far our biggest customer. They do over 1,000 UCC filings a month. It's a very significant revenue stream, but also a piece of activity. In 2007, 2008, they were almost exclusively paper filings, taking a lot of time on their end, John Deere's end, a tremendous amount of time on our end, and taking many days to complete, 2.5 to 3 days to complete the work. By working with their technology team, in a direct way, we were able to develop an XML way for the computers to talk to each other, and we've made the transition now so that those filings are being done electronically by automation, and so far this year there have been 0 paper filings. So that has allowed John Deere to save a lot of money. It's speeded up the process dramatically, but from our point of view, it has allowed us to free up about one person, because we've applied this same technology to some other of our big customers, to be available to help people when they walk through the door, when they call, who are trying to form new businesses. This part of our work, learning how to maintain a very high level of customer service while knowing we're going to have fewer staff to do that, is the focus of our attention, especially on the automation side. We've been working hard on our new Minnesota business and lean system, which is our move to an all-digital system. It will not eliminate the ability of people to come through the door and do things in person or come through the phone or that sort of thing. But it will allow all of our businesses in the state and the businesses outside of the state who use our services to have immediate and 24/7 access, but it also will permit the creation of that data as an available digital tool for people like King Banyan or Representative Banyan and others who might want to use this data. We're really excited about how automation has transformed our work, and we're excited about continuing to go down that path as fast as we can by implementing those new solutions. The second largest of our divisions is elections. This is the one that the public often thinks about unless they're in the business community. And this, the work of our elections division is the one that is divided, especially among so many levels of government. We work with county attorneys. They have exclusive jurisdiction over anything has to do with voting fraud or voting law violations. Township and city clerks are the, we have about 4,000 polling places. About half of them are townships, very small units typically. They're responsible for their own work of setting their polling place locations, hiring and training their election judges. So these are towns and townships. We call them municipalities often. And a few of them do administer their absentee voting at that level. by far the most important level of our elections administration is the county. Typically, the county auditor is the title. Typically, that person is the chief election officer in the county. They administer all the voter registration. They are the keepers and the owners, so to speak, of the list of voters, and all changes to those lists come through them and only through them. They accept candidate filings at the county level, and of course we also accept those at the state level, but that's somewhat of a new process for the counties. It's new work for them. They do the ballot layout, all the different kinds of ballots based on the school district and all of that kind of division. They're often, and this has been important, especially in the last decade, purchasing the new election equipment, testing it, maintaining it, transporting it, storing it, making sure it's properly aligned and all of that. They transmit the election night results to our statewide system, election night reporting system, and they do the canvassing of the results, the sort of local audit, so to speak, of the results, and if there are recounts, they conduct them that are within the county's jurisdiction. The Office of Secretary of State is, in a sense, the main partner and the backbone for much of this system. We train and certify those county election staff. The legislature has created certain requirements for the title of chief election officer. We accept candidate filings as well. We convene state canvassing board, and there has to be a recount that's under that jurisdiction. We provide the backbone computer services. Statewide Voter Registration System, or SVRS, is the voter registration backbone. Election Night Reporting is the name of the Election Night system that we use. And we provide voters lists. Perhaps you've rented voter lists from us, but for candidates and people running for office for political purpose, those lists are available to us. So, you know, those are the big things that we do within the elections work, and those two make up the bulk of our activities. But the Minnesota Constitution and state legislature has given us a number of specific tasks. State record keeping, we're the keeper of official documents. In my office outside there, you can go back and find all the original laws, and I highly recommend people come and look at some of those beautifully handwritten laws. We do the open appointments process. We don't make the appointments. We handle the paperwork part. And we produced the legislative record, the blue book. And I'm hoping that all of you have gotten one of these, but I understand some had not. And so every 2 years, and so we're working on the final part of the new one. This is the official record, and they go back nearly 150 years. And so that's part of our work. Another part of our activity that was assigned to us by the legislature is an address confidentiality program called Safe at Home. It's available to anyone who feels at risk, law enforcement, people in the judiciary, women who've been victims of domestic violence or stalking. Essentially gives them the right to have a post office box as their legal address. Staff then forward mail to them at their confidential address through first class mail. About 1,000 people have been served so far with this, and I've had law enforcement and other people say it's saved lives. And so this program was created by the legislature in 06, funded in 07, and it's been up and running, you know, for a relatively short period of time, but it's had a positive effect. The next slide looks at the civic education. We don't ever have very much money for this, but we do a pretty good job of lining up partners. During the sesquicentennial, we partnered with Hubbard Broadcast and Dolan Media to bring the Declaration of Independence to the History Center. This year, it's a sesquicentennial of the Civil War, and we're partnering, hopefully, with some of the same people to bring the U.S. Constitution. Our Vote in Honor of a Veteran program, some of you have seen this button or even worn them, was a partnership with Kids Voting, Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Association for the U.S. Army. And about 80,000 people wore these buttons, and a lot of the tributes are in the blue book that you've gotten, especially some from your own districts. In the back, they are indexed with everything else. But just opening up the blue book and reading a few of the tributes will give you a sense of how powerful this program was and how it affected people. We do a lot of things around the symbols of democracy, including things to do with the state capitol. Our flag etiquette work is well-known throughout the state, and we have given you some samples of this. If you would like any of these materials for your office here or back in the district or for your church or anything, please let us know. This work we consider very important. There is never very much money for it, but that's the way it goes. Since 2003, The federal government has played a big role in elections, including being a major part of the funding for the office through the Help America Vote Act. We signed an agreement with them that made three promises in exchange for getting about $49 million overall. First, to follow our HAVA plan, Help America Vote plan. Second, to make a 5% match, which has been part of our ongoing match in the budget. And third, to maintain our effort. They come out and periodically audit us to make sure that we haven't cut back on our spending on elections by substituting federal money. But that money has been important for a lot of different things. $35 million or so, $36 million perhaps, has gone to the local communities to buy equipment, optical scan equipment, equipment for people with disabilities. A lot of you have seen these in your polling places. There's about $3.6 million, I believe, that's still available. That's part of their ongoing maintenance. These are great machines to buy, but they have to be maintained. They have to be programmed. They have to be kept current and up to date. In addition to that, HAVA money was available to put in ramps and electric doors to help townships in particular, but others to be more accessible. They were available for public education, especially in the work has focused on the disabilities community, how to use these new pieces of equipment. And then also for matching purposes, we use this to build the statewide voter registration database and then to run matches against the Department of Public Safety, Department of Corrections, the Postal Service, the Social Security Administration's Death Registry. There's a whole list of lists that we are by statute required to use to help strengthen and make sure our list is clean and has integrity, and we use the funds for there. There's about $2.6 million left in that account, which will be more or less the amount needed for the next biennium for the list matching, the statewide voter registration, the absentee ballot tracking, those kinds of things. We are working with our members of Congress to try to get the federal government to meet their obligation and to appropriate more money. I'm not necessarily banking on that or betting the farm. I don't see them doing it, but they might. So we have to be thinking not the next biennium, but out in the future. No HAVA funds. What do we do to make sure our communities, our townships, have the funds they need to keep our elections modern? There's a lot of information about HAVA, and Bert Black is here today from my staff, a 30-year veteran of our office. He's been here since the beginning, the long arc of HAVA. So if we have some specific questions, either today or in writing, Bert's kind of backup for me. What we do because we think the citizens expect our office to be really high quality, whether it's on integrity or service or efficiency. And we also know that the businesses have a choice. And so we operate our office to try to meet the highest expectations. And every once in a while, somebody will write us. I mean, every week we get some great comments, but I just want to end by a note from somebody who emailed our office appreciation. The subject line he put was delighted. And he said, as a representative of the single largest filer of UCCs in the known universe, and by the way, this company is the largest in the universe, I speak to a lot of jurisdictions on a regular basis. I often get quick service, and I often get treated professionally and courteously, as he should, representing the largest in the universe. However, today, when calling your office and speaking to Teresa, I was honored with the best that anyone could expect. The phone rang once. I was greeted graciously. I then got all the information that I needed so quickly I could hardly believe the call was complete. Teresa's use of your system was not only impressive, but her manner was delightful. I want to be sure that you know that we, the public, appreciate that kind of top-notch service. Thanks, Kirk Johnson, CT Lean Solutions. And I would add that behind Teresa, behind that frontline staff, are the IT and administrative staff who build those systems that make things available to handle calls quickly so we can move on and serve all the public as well. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity. Thank you, members. I look forward to your questions today at our future session, but also at any time. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Secretary. We have several who have questions right now. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Secretary. Good seeing you again today.
Thank you very much.
You mentioned one thing that's near and dear to me, and that's integrity in the voting system. And one of the things that I constantly hear, especially when I was on the campaign trail, and most polls, I think all polls, kind of bear out that 85% plus of Minnesotans would like to see some kind of photo ID bill passed and be used to help the judges qualify candidate or voters as they come through the voting place. And my question is about the HAVA funds that are available. I guess I did have an understanding that it was about $5 million left at the end of November, but I'll take your updated numbers of about $3.6 million remaining for the counties, $2.6 anticipated remainder at the end of 2011. My question to you is, could some of those funds be used to procure voter ID machines so that the county auditors have the proper equipment if a bill was passed to actually help people that don't have current photo IDs get free ones if necessary?
Chairman Ritchie. Chairman Lanning, Representative Benson, it's not currently in the HAVA plan, so the answer would be no.
It's not in the HAVA plan, but does that mean that the federal government is precluded allowing those funds to be used in that manner?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, I don't know if the federal government has expressed an interest in it one way or the other. What they've said is you have to live by your HAVA plan. There's a procedure for transforming the HAVA plan. You explain to the counties funds won't be available for your voting machines. They're going to be used for electronic poll books. They would express their point of view on that. There would be a decision by the HAVA Council as to whether that was the way they wanted to go, not replace their machines and to purchase electronic poll books or purchase equipment. The kind of numbers that people are talking about with some of the current proposals, 20 to 40 million, is of course far beyond anything that HAVA would be available for. But the HAVA funds in particular, have very specific requirements that have been made for them by the federal government and by the state legislature, and so you'd have to undo those to move that procedure forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benson.
So a statutory, we're going to pass a law, well, hypothetically, it's signed. The requirement is that each county auditor have a machine that can produce a free ID card for those who need it, voter identification. Clarification, I know it's not in the HAVA plan, but now you have a bill that says this is what we need to do. The money can be spent or cannot be spent in that manner.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Benson, we're now into legal questions. I'm not a lawyer. I do have our office attorney who's been with the HAVA for a long time. If I believe we're talking about legal questions now, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not qualified to answer that particular question. We could ask Mr. Black, or we could send you a letter about this and look into it further.
Representative Benson?
Yes, I'd like to get an answer about how those funds, or if those funds could be used in that manner. Thank you.
Not now. You mean in writing?
You can answer it right now. And later in writing.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Bert Black. I'm the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State since 2002. The question you asked was about, at least the last version was about photo ID machines at county auditors. That is not currently in the HAVA state plan, so even if a statute were to be passed, those monies could not be expended for that purpose. It's not in the HAVA state plan. The state plan would have to be changed, amended to do that. That's a federal requirement.
Mr. Benson, Representative Benson?
I'd also like then in the letter explaining what it would take then the process to change the HAVA plan and whether or not this body doesn't have the authority to override a plan because it's how we spend money. But I would like that clarified in your letter, please.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Secretary Ritchie. First, I'd like to commend you for your educational programs and your interest in history. Secretary Ritchie and I worked together on the Lincoln bicentennial of his birth, and I think we'll be on some Civil War issues as well. In fact, we had a conversation yesterday about that. But Moving to my question, how many instances of voter fraud were identified statewide in the last election?
Secretary Ritchie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Verdahl, what I've seen in the reports is that there were 38 cases. Almost all were felons not yet off paper who voted in the election. We have joint activity with Wisconsin on a couple people who it appears voted in both states, but they have been indicted in Wisconsin because that was the second place. So, you know, 38 to 40, it's something in that range.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Ritchie, are they then all prosecuted, and what is the penalty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl. Almost all election law violations in Minnesota are felonies, and they are prosecuted, investigated and prosecuted at the county level by the county attorneys. The first case, the one in a way that got a lot of publicity, a young man in Kitson County, I think near the town of War Road, had just gotten out of prison. Really wanted to participate in the election. This is 2008. Called his parole officer, say, hey, I'm going to be a good citizen. I'm going down to vote. He didn't know that he couldn't vote. And so by the time his parole officer got the message and called him back saying, no, don't go, don't vote. You'll go back to prison. He had gone down and voted. He was a strong supporter of Senator McCain and Senator Coleman, and he wanted to vote. And he was prosecuted. But they reduced it to a gross misdemeanor. He got 30 days in the county workhouse instead of a year in prison, which would be the normal. And I think it's because he said out loud, hey, I didn't hide the fact. I wasn't trying to defraud anybody. I called to tell you I thought I was being a good citizen. And it is a little confusing because in North Dakota, the law is different. If you're incarcerated in North Dakota, you can't vote. If you're not incarcerated, you can. But anyhow, this young man, you know, it cost the county quite a bit of money to prosecute. He went back to jail. It kind of took him off the path of getting his life back together. But they did reduce it from a felony to a gross misdemeanor. So I think that's in the option of a county attorney to make that kind of a decision if they so choose.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Secretary. Thanks for coming before the committee. Since this is a finance committee and you're here because we're the committee that deals with your budget, I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of perspective over the last couple of biennia in terms of, I mean, not to the penny, but what kind of cuts have been imposed, what has your FTE count been over the last couple biennia, and what, when you've had to economize and make cuts, where have those come from within the office?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, we've lost about 10% a year, and whatever was imposed by the governor as an allotment, we voluntarily agreed to be the same. Whatever was imposed by the legislature, more or less, we always got the same. It's been about 10% a year. It's a bit of a struggle because the promise of HAVA to maintain our effort on elections means that the cuts have to come out of business services as a practical matter. And we have 7 of our full-time equivalent positions unfilled at the moment. Everything from, you know, my administrative assistant to, you know, folks who are frontline workers in this way. And those positions, we've been able to, so to speak, handle the big increase in volume, although we have fewer people, by the automation that we've already brought online as part of our Minnesota Businesses and Lean System, our automation program. I mentioned the John Deere example because that basically freed up one whole person who then was able to be redeployed to handle the higher volume on the phone and coming in. We have imagined that future for ourselves for a while, that there would be less money, and you know, that's been the reality. We have been able to bring on a couple. CT Corporation comes to mind, which is our second largest customer. They've had a similar opportunity to use our automated systems with great success. And I feel like that is the future for us going forward. But here's the caution from our side. Any business has a choice. They can go to Delaware because Delaware is aggressive about business filings or anything else. And so we have to be very careful. A few years ago, there was a sharp budget crisis. The solution that was looked at and imposed in Office of Secretary of State was to close the business service counter for half a day throughout the week. And this created chaos for businesses from one end of the country to the other. And to this day, local, particularly the big law firms who serve businesses who compete nationally with the law firms in Boston and Chicago and New York, report that they have difficulty because attorneys and business consultants and advisors in other states sometimes say to even Minnesotans, but to other businesses, hey, you don't want to file in Minnesota because they're never closed, or they're never open, or they're just open half time, or they're kind of a backwater. So it damaged our reputation dramatically. And the end result is that the businesses here who support the businesses in their filings and their legal activities and all of that suffer a competitive disadvantage from that negative image of our office, because in an earlier budget crisis, a decision was made to close the office on a half-day basis. And so we want to make sure that our 24/7 services and our online, in-person, over-the-phone, human being services are there and available, so that our great reputation, and I shared that one, but we get many emails a week from people expressing their appreciation. We want to maintain a very high reputation, restore the damage that happened to our registration, our reputation in the past, and make sure in the future that businesses, Minnesota businesses and others, want to file with their office. They have a choice. There's a marketplace out there for filings, and we want to be the place where Minnesotans and others want to start their businesses and want to bring their business of UCC filings or whatever it might be.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, quick follow-up. I think it's probably no surprise to you, you're probably going to be cut again this year, as is darn near everyone. So I assume that the seven FTEs that you speak of, now that you've got the 69, I assume that the seven is above and beyond the 69. You have 69 now. You have seven that are unfilled right now. I know we'll have you back when we discuss the specifics of your budget, but are you sort of assuming at this point that you will not at all ever fill those seven, or you really don't know? It's based on what we do here later in the session.
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, the activity in our office has grown dramatically. I mentioned that we had a spike in 2009, but we have had steady growth in all of the different kind of filings that we have. And so we have to imagine that that will continue. Minnesota is a strong new business creation climate that's going to go forward. We will be able to automate a number of things, but the necessity of somebody to be there on the phone and answer a question, or to open the door after 5 because somebody needs a document because they've got a filing the next morning or whatever, will remain. And so we don't imagine shrinking our office down to zero, but we don't imagine that we're going to have, you know, more staff in the near future. But our belief that our office generates significant funding that goes into the general fund, because it does a good job, that maintaining our ability to do a good job is in the interest of maximizing the revenue stream for the general fund, and that there will be some kind of a balance in that process. We, like you, anticipate additional cuts, and my staff have been around, many of them, a long time. They are very familiar with the cuts. And my planning and the planning of the whole staff for the cuts, I think, is very professional and sophisticated. But here's my biggest problem. The most senior of my staff, who've been through a lot of cuts, know the heartache of those cuts. They've been around 30-some years, and now they have grandchildren, and they like to fish. And so they're trying to say, do I stick around and go through the heartache of another round of cuts, or do I choose my grandkids and a different kind of life in retirement? And I've been saying to them in as most passionate of a voice as I can, please stay. As we are being cut, we need your expertise, your institutional memory even more. But I promise you we will have an organized process for transferring the knowledge and wisdom experience to younger staff so that when you do go with those grandkids and start fishing and retire, you can leave knowing that your knowledge and wisdom has been passed on. So we need to organize our cutting and reductions and all of these with an eye towards the generational shift in our agencies. And I've been asking some of our private sector companies who've successfully managed intergenerational leadership transitions for assistance in this process. But I'm focused on how to make sure that as we lose our most senior and experienced people, their knowledge isn't just lost or disappeared and they just go to Florida, but that we've convinced them to stay long enough to suffer the heartache of the next phase and pass on their wisdom and experience so that the agency stays strong going forward. How do you replace an institutional knowledge of a Burt Black is a big question, but we have to do it and we have to face it.
Members, we have about 5 minutes left for this segment, and then we're going to have to shift gears. We have several more who have questions. Representative Kahn. Yes.
Mr. Chairman and Secretary Ritchie, two quick questions. One of the things, talking about the voter ID issue, one of the things I think we've tried to do several times without success is to do automatic voter registration with automobile with driver's licenses. And it seems to me that's the closest thing. I don't know what proportion of people in the state have driver's license, but that would give you on record a photo ID specifically. Is there any plans to move forward on that again this year?
Secretary Ritchie.
Representative Manning, Chairman Manning, Representative Kahn, you're right that automatic voter registration via the DPS system, Department of Public Safety system, would give us a much higher and much cleaner record. We know three-fourths of the folks doing same-day registration are just changing their address. Almost all are using a Minnesota-issued ID or license. So you're absolutely correct that that would give us a much bigger list. There's somewhere between 100-some thousand, 225,000. We don't really know, and there's quite a few laws that make it complicated to use the, you know, use the vehicle services list. But you know, between 100 and 200,000 people don't, and there are, you know, people just are libertarians and don't want to register with government. I mean, there's all kinds of things that go on in the process, but here is one thing we are thinking about, and you asked specifically if we were going to move on this year, and you know, I don't know with everything else we need to think about in terms of the budget, if we will, but making the Department of Public Safety database available on an online system, like now we use CRIMNET as a statewide system, or in a laptop, so that in a polling place, you could load the list from corrections so you know who's under a felony charge and who's not yet off paper. You could load the Social Security death registry of the most recent deaths. You could load, for example, the information that we have about citizenship directly. And then you could run those two lists either in a cloud computing solution or, you know, in a kind of network solution. You can imagine kind of how to do this and then begin to build a future towards that. Having the maximum number of people when they get their driver's license who are going to want to register and vote or be part of the democracy to be registered there on the spot would be crucial, because that is the place where now everyone is presenting citizenship data. And Department of Vehicle Services is the one place within our state system where that data is available. So we are strongly in favor of moving in that automated direction. I don't know exactly how that conversation will unfold this year, but it's definitely the future.
But so again, since this is a finance committee, the point is if we did that and then move to requiring photo ID for the one quarter that don't have driver's license and set some system in place to do that, like using automation. I don't think you'd need a machine in every county. You know, maybe it would be all right if we went down to my 10-county proposal that's been around for a while. But it seemed to me that would significantly reduce the cost of that from the $20 million we're talking about.
Chair. Representative Kahn, we're going to have an opportunity to discuss that and debate that here in bills that are coming before us. And we really need to move on to quickly get the others who have asked for recognition. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. If I could just make a request of the Secretary, and in when you come back for your budget presentation, if you could provide for us, I don't know what kind of time window, but let's say maybe a 10 to 15-year picture of the HAVA funds from their inception and how they have been spent, and then maybe what the projections are by year going forward. My sense is that we've got a classic case where the federal government or state or whoever funds the initial implementation of something, and all of a sudden we've got all this technology and all this infrastructure sitting out there that has to be maintained, and I'm guessing we haven't budgeted or funded the ongoing maintenance. We've got a classic kind of unfunded mandate or an expense stream that no one's even thinking about yet in the out year. So if we could see that. And then secondly, similar to that, your staff model, you talked about the seven FTEs. I'd be curious to see the staffing maybe over the last 10 years and maybe by type of staff or department or something so that we could see what those reductions have been and how that might play forward. That would be helpful for us as we go through our budget deliberations with you.
Secretary Ritchie, I take it with your head nod, that's a yes.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've had some pretty close elections over the last 4 or 5 years, and much to my chagrin, someone who loves their state, I remember an article January 5th of 2009 from the Wall Street Journal, and the title was the most disconcerting. It was Something Smells in Minnesota. But it pointed out some issues regarding, you know, potential voter issues. I think they cite 25 precincts where the number of votes didn't equal the number of voters and so on. This comes to mind, of course, after Representative Udall. I'm just wondering how closely your office follows. You had some information relative to the person who voted in Wisconsin and Minnesota. But I know there is a group under investigation in the university area for vouching and or not vouching or vouching for people they shouldn't have been, the members of the Student Organizing for America group. Are you following that? Do you know whether or not that investigation is going to lead to any charges or just any information you can provide?
Chairman Lanning, Representative Benson, I remember that editorial very well because the day after it I got a death threat and 1,000 vulgar emails as a result of it, so it's quite strongly in my memory. To the specific instance, as far as I know, the county attorneys, which is the only person that does investigations and prosecutions, has put quite a few staff in looking into this, so we stay out of you know, legal investigations because that is the authority of the county attorneys, but we're always paying attention to this. I think the thing that Representative Erdahl's question pointed out was that on a percentage basis, you know, Minnesota's elections are known in the country as the cleanest in the country for good reason when you compare it to any other state or any other jurisdiction. But we always need to figure out ways to do better. So, for example, the 38 that were felons who voted, who almost all of them said they did not know and were not told, like the young man who wanted to vote for Senator McCain and Senator Coleman argued he didn't know. The legislature passed very, very strong bipartisan basis a bill in the last session to require the judges to say to a felon, you are losing your right to vote, so that they could then no longer argue or no one could say like the young man did in War Road, I didn't know. That bill passed on a very bipartisan basis. Unfortunately, it was vetoed, but I hope the legislature picks that up again, because if felons aren't told they've lost the right to vote, it's both difficult for the county attorneys to prosecute them, but also, like the young man up on War Road, they make a mistake thinking they're doing the right thing, which derails their life again just when they're trying to get their life together. So I do think there are legislative things that could be done. Some have been done, although vetoed, that I would urge everyone to be looking at.
One last question, and then we need to shift gears. Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll take this in an entirely different direction for just a minute. And thank you for recognizing our report in Central Minnesota Quarterly Business Report and using information on incorporations and assumed name registrations as a source of information. I'm curious about what your future plans are with that process. You have now automated the filings, but there is a wealth of information in there, part of which I've been able to find and use, but there are lots of other people who could learn a lot more about the state of Minnesota and its business climate from reading the information there. So my question is, what plans do you have in terms of being able to provide, maybe a computerized basis of means of disseminating the information that's there?
Secretary Ritchie.
Chairman Lanning. Representative Banyan, well, my first plan is to come visit your office fairly often to find out what information you've been getting and how you've done it. But to be more direct, we have moved completed phase one of basically digitizing everything. There are phase two and phase three, which take the physical image documents from years and years ago, but not as important as the current data, so that it becomes physically available. I have to say that our focus has been on the infrastructure creation stabilization part of that, and we need to move our attention to, hey, what information do we have? Can it be made easily available? And we need outside people, academics, regional development directors, companies to say, hey, and then we need to say, you know, if we just moved it 5 degrees this way, or if we asked this kind of question, we would have more valuable data than we even have now, because right now it's kind of a receptacle. So in the use by the outside world informing us, we can then make those adjustments to make that information available. And I read the ROI magazine from the region and the regional economic development, and the fact that you use that to do leading economic indicator projections is amazing to me, and I want to somehow let other regional economic development analysts or specialists to know this is a fairly simple thing to do. On an even simpler level, a number of chambers of commerce or business groups now get the feed of the new filings in their zip code area. It just tells them their prospects of knocking on the door and say, hey, come join our chamber. I see that you formed a new business. So any and all suggestions and ideas, I'm really looking forward to getting past the infrastructure building part of this so we can get more to making that information valuable part of my job.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Ritchie, you've identified exactly where I think we need to go next is in terms of helping economic development professionals get the kind of information they need so that they can determine where they move next in terms of providing for growth. And this is particularly important, I think, for folks in greater Minnesota. And so I really look forward to that conversation with you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Secretary Ritchie, Ms. Frazier, thank you very much for being here today. And we will have you back again before very long to talk more about budgets.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My staff informed me that the 7 open positions are 5 full-time equivalents, but we will do a whole documentation in response to the requests that were made.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you for being here. Next, we're going to move to an overview of the Office of Enterprise Technology, and we're pleased to introduce the new Chief Information Officer for the State of Minnesota, Carolyn Parnell. If she would come forward. And I understand we've got several other of staff from that department that will also be presenting to us. Ms. Parnell, welcome. Congratulations on your new assignment, and I think it would be helpful if you would introduce yourself, give a little of your background to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to be here. I don't technically start until Monday, but I couldn't resist this opportunity to get a head start. I'm here to listen and learn, much as you are. It would be very premature for me to comment on anything about the Office of Enterprise Technology beyond the fact that I do bring with me a very positive impression of it. I have had interactions with the agency through my career, and I look forward to digging in deeper and learning more. For most of my career, I have been involved with institutions that offer services to the students of Minnesota. I really welcome the opportunity to expand that and offer services to all the citizens of Minnesota. I feel that my job is to ensure that citizens are well-connected, well-informed, and I take that responsibility seriously.
Well, thank you, and we wish you the best, and we look forward to having further conversations with you and your department once you've taken over and we are deep into the budgets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your time.
And so whoever is going to go next, if you would please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you so much for the invitation to appear before you today to talk a little bit about the Office of Enterprise Technology and do our overview. We're going to get set up here in just a few seconds. So I'm Sarah Schlatteroff, Deputy CIO for the state of Minnesota. As you just learned, we have a CIO as of yesterday, and we're really excited about that, especially since she knows something about OET, and we expect to have her hit the ground running, and we're, again, delighted to have her in a leadership role for our organization. Today we're here to talk to you about our overview, our agency. We're going to touch on governance and oversight, specifically related to security. We're going to talk a little bit about services that we provide to our customers, focusing most on data center co-location as well as enterprise utility communications and collaboration, which is essentially enterprise email. And then we'll talk about a couple other issues as we close our comments. So first, the basics, OET's mission. We provide leadership and services that improve government through the effective use of information technology, pretty basic. Our vision is to be a trusted leader. We're a service agency, so we provide leadership for the enterprise IT services in the state of Minnesota. We also work hard to try to be a provider of choice for our customers. We're a rate-for-service agency. We have to earn our keep. We're a market-based entity, and we focus on trying to run the organization like a business. So what do we do? We have two primary focus areas. First, governance and oversight. These responsibilities are defined by statute. We do leadership regarding policy, enterprise planning and governance, enterprise security, and again, you're going to hear a little bit more about that program. And then compliance and standards in a variety of different areas, architecture, product standards, contracts, portfolio management, project investment are all areas that we provide compliance and standards. The most mature aspect of that particular part of our entity is standards and contractors. All purchases within the state of Minnesota, for example, IT purchases have to go through a process, an internal process that we have to make sure that they comply with standards. The other part of our organization, technology services, is sort of the bread and butter of our organization. We provide a number of utility services, which means that we have enterprise agreement that all of the services that are constituted as utility services are provided the same by everyone in state government. And then we also have market-based services, which essentially you buy as you want and need. And we'll talk a little bit about the customers for each one of those services. In terms of the scope of our activities, it's important to note that we're a $100 million organization, which, again, is a rate-for-service entity. 94% of our budget comes directly from customers. We have to demonstrate our value to them every single day, otherwise some of the money could be jeopardized. Only 6% of our budget actually comes in the form of general funds. And then some just detail in terms of the pie chart, which constitutes the makeup of the 94%. 88% comes from the Enterprise Technology Fund, we call it our 970 fund. The rest come from 200 funds. In case you're wondering what that is, agencies are able to send money over to us in a special revenue fund for predetermined projects that are signed off by MMB and used for, again, enterprise efforts. The rest of the funds, in terms of general fund, go directly to security, 4% of our budget, and then we have some basic funds, 2%, that go for basic admin services, our communications, folks leadership, those kinds of things. So now a little bit about our customers. Again, in the governance and oversight aspect, which is defined by statute, our primary customer base is the state of Minnesota executive branch. Other Minnesota government entities are optional. Some opt to come on board with us because they like the way that we do work. They want standards. They want a common way to do things. In terms of our technology services, we touch all aspects of the public sector. That includes executive branch, counties, Minsky is a part of that, the U of M cities. K-12 buys off our standards regarding their contracts. They're a big user. They buy all their laptops, their PCs off of our contract. And then we have some other public sector entities that opt in as well. So that's a little bit about our customer base. In terms of customer breakdown, by volume, this is a pie chart again that defines what percentage are state agencies, higher ed, county, cities, and public schools. So you can see a little bit about the volume of the people that we serve every day in OET. So before we get into security, I just want to touch on governance for a minute. Again, we're a service entity, so it's very important that as we move forward, our market's always based on where our customers want us to go. We need to have customers to consume our services, and that's our funding model. So in terms of how we make decisions, we have a governance process which represents technology, business, and finance. Essentially, how it works is the CIOs meet on a monthly basis, determine service direction, we facilitate that process, and then technology makes recommendations to the business and finance, which are deputy commissioners as well as CFOs in state agencies. They then make recommendations onto the commissioners for consideration and finally to the governor. We have a number of areas where we have achieved progress in terms of an enterprise level. They're mentioned on the slide, which include e-licensing, security again, IT products and standard, architecture, data centers, enterprise email, as well as project and portfolio management. All aspects of those projects come through our governance process, and it's really important, again, that we have a solid base in terms of our customers for how we move forward. One of the areas that we have the most defined governance effort, because again it impacts all aspects of executive branch as well as local governments, is in the area of enterprise security, a subject that you care about because again it's about protecting the state's data, but also because you fund it as a finance committee, and that's the biggest portion of our general fund allocation. So right now I'd like to introduce to you Chris Buzzi, our state security officer, and he's going to provide some comments about the security unit of our department.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Christopher Buzzi. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the state of Minnesota.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I would like to start off by building on something that Ms. Schlatterhoff just pointed out about the governance process. When most people think about enterprise security for the state of Minnesota, I think the natural tendency is to think about an organization that protects the executive branch and state agencies. And by and large, we do that. We're going to talk today about some conceptual roles that we have in that space, and we're also going to give you an overview of some of the things that we've actually done since our inception and creation about 4 years ago. But before I go into that that part of our operation, I wanted to talk about enterprise security and some of our roles on a broader level. The enterprise security program in the state of Minnesota, and for that matter, for all other states, really plays a critical element, critical role in the national security fabric. So if you look at the graphic on the slide, you can see that state government really sits in the middle. And one of the things that we do is we provide a vital link between what goes on in the security space at the national level, primarily through the Federal Department of Homeland Security and the United States Computer Emergency Response Team. We take a lot of information on a daily basis, a lot of threat feeds that we get from them, and one of the roles that we play is to make sure that that vital security information gets passed on, not only through the executive branch of government, but through the legislative judicial branches as well, and through higher education. And we also have a role of passing that information down into local units of government as well. And there is a very defined fabric to make that happen. It's called the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center. It's one of 17 national ISACs that were created after 9/11 to, as it was said at that time, connect the dots. So the MSISAC is a group that we're a vital member of, and our goal is to take security information and filter it up and down and across to our organization to make sure that when bad events are happening, we alert our partners and help them understand how they need to react to that. So that's the national presence that the Enterprise Security Program brings, and it's an important presence to not only state government, but to local government officials as well. So on a broad level, I think it's important to understand, well, what are the security risks that we face on a daily basis? And I really put those into three major buckets. First of all, we have a risk that we face for cyber attacks on critical government systems. And those really fall in a couple different varieties. We have individuals that try to deny access or disable critical government services. This is called the denial of service attack. It's the kind of thing that we see on a daily basis in state agencies in the enterprise security program. We also have episodes where people simply try to sabotage government systems. It's typically hate groups or other groups that just have a political grudge against government. The second major category of risk that we face is the loss of sensitive data. Obviously, when you look across the scope of government, we house a lot of very critical sensitive data for individuals. Most people are aware of identity theft. That's the theft of information for financial gain. We also worry about employee errors as well in this category, just simple mistakes or policy problems that we have that result in the loss of sensitive data. And then finally, our enterprise security program focuses on how do we put in place the types of controls to respond to disasters that may happen, whether they're man-made computer failures or other kinds of hacking of those kind of events that may happen to disrupt services. Conceptually, we feel like we ultimately need to be good in quite a few different spaces to address a lot of the issues that we've talked about in prior hearings and that you read about in the legislative audit reports. First of all, we need to play a strong role in planning and policy direction, basically setting the bar that the state needs to have as a whole. We also are the focal point for investigating security breaches. We support shared security tools so that we can put solutions in place that can provide security services across all government agencies. We serve as a security information broker. Basically, when bad things happen, we get out there and we let the agencies know on an ongoing basis what they need to do, problems that may be going on in their environment. We also spend a great deal of time trying to architect security controls into new computer systems and applications. A good example that we're going to talk about later when Mr. Tomes comes up to speak about some of the things that we're doing in the technology service area is trying to make sure we have the appropriate controls in the upcoming cloud computing solution that we're putting in place for messaging services. And then finally, working to help better prepare our state to recover critical systems in times of crisis. an area that Mr. Noble has pointed out in a prior legislative audit that definitely needs some assistance. So moving on to talk briefly about what are some of the things that we're actually doing in the planning and governance side of our operation. One of the things that I'm very proud of is we're one of the few states in the nation that actually has a written security strategic and tactical plan. We now have updated our tactical plan for the second time, but basically putting a plan in place that goes through the governance process where all agencies come together and say, given the limited resources that we have at our disposal, what are the most important things that we need to do first? We also are putting in place the baseline policies and standards that our government needs. The policy framework is done for the enterprise as a whole. Now we're working on putting in place the enterprise standards that actually implement those broad policies into day-to-day agency operations. We do quite a bit of work in security incident response and computer forensics. This is one area that we're working to get better metrics together, and as of January, we're starting to gather enterprise-wide metrics on security incidents. But on average, we're helping manage about 100 security incidents a month across the government, some being simple things such as malware, which has infected computers, to more serious issues that require forensic investigation services. We also operate a vulnerability and threat management service today. This is probably one of the most important things I think we've done as an enterprise security program, but it's a solution that helps us perform ongoing and continuous assessments of all government computers across the executive branch of government, and in this particular case, we also partner with higher education as well, collectively performing about 30,000 to 40,000 assessments per day, and looking at 152,000 computers in total. Security monitoring is one area that you read about in every legislative audit as being deficient. We're working in that area to try and develop security monitoring solutions to give us better situational awareness to understand what's going on across our networks. Today, we're making progress. We have monitoring solutions in place for OET's major data centers that we operate. And we also have agreements to extend that service out to strategic partners who are willing to contribute to the cost model. Partners such as the Revenue Department, the Secretary of State is a key partner of ours as well. We are working on some of the perennial access control problems that you also have read about time and time again in every legislative audit report. Today we are in the process of trying to build ways that we can manage credentials more effectively so that we don't have hundreds or possibly thousands of access control pools that need to be separately managed all across the government. We're working on training and awareness activities, and I really put those into two separate buckets. When I say training, we're trying to do things to improve the competency of IT professionals across government to make them understand security risks better than they do today. For example, coming up on March 2nd and 3rd, we're hosting a class which 16 agencies will be participating in on how to combat malware in their organizations. About 30 individuals will be participating in that class we're hosting. We also do general awareness activities as well to the best of our ability. We had 16 events that we sponsored in October during Cybersecurity Awareness Month. We're doing the best that we can to help improve our continuity of operations posture with government. This is one of for the first time ever, our government is collecting metrics on which agencies have continuity of operations plans and which agencies are actually testing the recovery strategies for their critical systems. As I mentioned earlier, we're helping build security controls into key government computer systems by participating in the upfront design of systems with architectural assistance. And finally, in the compliance area, we're starting to gather metrics. And one of the things that's really important for us is to be able to demonstrate that we are, in fact, the controls that we're putting in place are, in fact, working and that we're making progress to improve our security posture. So to summarize it all, the Enterprise Security Program exists to provide that national that national piece of the security infrastructure for the state as a whole, and to help bring the federal government together and all branches of state government and the local governments. But within the executive branch and within higher education as well, we're trying to partner to put in place a lot of different badly needed security controls. And with the help that we've got, primarily through the general fund appropriation that you've given us, we've been able to make some substantial progress. Obviously, a lot of work needs to be made, but I'm proud of the work that's been done today by our office and the other security professionals across state government who are partnering with us.
Question from Representative Benson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions. One of them just maybe yes or no. The other one maybe a little bit more drawn out. But the first one is, you ever had any of the departments come to you and say, I'd like to find out how much time my employees are spending on social networking sites and doing any monitoring, or is that something that you can do?
Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the succinct answer is no, I have not had that type of question. We're really focusing on some pretty heavy security incidents where there's malware and infections, and we really try to stay out of the HR space to the extent possible.
Granted, but there's two of you up there. I just wondered if maybe you might want to respond. Do you know of anybody who's ever asked whether or not there's any monitoring for how much time spent in social networking?
Ms. Schlatteroff?
Mr. Chair, committee members, as Chris said, from a security standpoint, we do not get involved in those kinds of things. HR, from time to time, does ask those kinds of questions when they're conducting an investigation, and we would participate as much as we're able if the question was posed.
Right.
Representative Benson.
My other question goes back to a previous presentation, and maybe you can, and maybe I should wait for a better time. But my question is on chargebacks. I've only been here about 4 weeks, but I've already begun to heard noise from departments about the cost of chargeback. I happen to represent a number of people who work at IBM in my district, so I'm very conscious of the solutions that they provide. And I'm just wondering, are your chargebacks market-based? How do you arrive at what you charge? My feeling is people will be using you more and will have more solutions and more eager to use the kinds of things that would make their departments more efficient if it was market-based, more affordable.
Ms. Schlatteroff?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the next person that's going to come up to provide testimony to your committee is from our customer service unit, Tarek Tomes, and he can talk a little bit more about that. But essentially, over the last couple of years, we spent a lot of time analyzing both what our costs are for the service and are we market competitive or not. We have a service strategy team which has organized our services by the service stack, and they routinely go through each of the service to say, what is our cost point today? What is the consumption rate? Are our volumes steady? Are they decreasing, increasing? What is the cost, or how do we compete? How do we compare with other market-based entities who provide the same service? Should we think differently about how we provide that service? Should we consider strategic sourcing for an aspect of that service or not? And it's a community decision-making process and a community decision point. And then they make recommendations.
Representative Benson.
Here, I'll reserve a question. I would like to get information relative to the information you just said in terms of determining whether or not it is market derived, and whether or not how do you compare. So I'd like to see some of that information. You can wait for the next presenter, or if they're in the audience right now, that's my interest.
I also had a related question, and that is, who decides whether you're charging enough or too much, and what's the process of determining whether your charges are appropriate, be it market based or just appropriate to cover costs? Who makes that decision? How is it made? And if you want to defer, fine. But that's a follow up question that I would have as well.
Mr. Chair, committee members, certainly we'll provide more testimony regarding that issue. By and large, our customers decide because they decide to either consume our services or go elsewhere for their service. We don't have a monopoly in our business, and there are certain areas that they have to consume because they're utility services, but by and large, otherwise they have other alternatives if it's a market-based service. So we can provide more information on how that works. sometimes there may be reasons why our services may be a little more expensive than market, but there's often reasons why. For example, we know their business, or we provide services to agencies that perhaps cannot afford market, so we have to cover that. So there's all kinds of decision points about why we get to our cost or our price for service. And again, it's an open process. We share our prices with our customer. We have an annual rate process where we go through and review each of our rates, share it with the customers, talk about if they've gone up or where there's dollar reductions. And so it's a very customer-driven process. But we can provide more information as well on that subject.
Well, I guess your explanation begs another question, and that is that when it comes to security, that ought not be an option on the various state agencies or departments. I mean, you're in the business of protecting the security of state systems, and that's, people shouldn't have an option to go elsewhere when it comes to security. So how do you sort the costs of providing that security from your other customer preferences that there may be?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we have a baseline of security services that everyone must consume. We have standards and policies that everyone has to comply with. For example, encryption of their PDAs, their personal devices, they have to be encrypted, otherwise they can't use them because the state's data has to be protected. There is a market-based aspect to security services as well. Some of our departments want to consume more than baseline. For example, if they have particular statutory guidelines that provides different restrictions on sharing of data or different levels of security that aren't the norm, they can consume beyond the baseline, and we assist them. They also have individual security departments as well, which Chris coordinates on a leadership level and makes sure that they comply with statute. I don't know if you want to add any more comments to that.
Mr. Busey?
Mr. Chair, committee members, your analysis is absolutely right. And the problem that we're facing today is collectively as a community and as a government, as a governance body, we've worked hard to identify those core services that absolutely need to be in place. Today we're certainly not there. We all know that we need to be better, and we need to have comprehensive monitoring, for example, to know what's going on across government. The only thing that we need to do now is we need to keep continuing on our plan to get those types of solutions in place. But your analysis is correct. Security needs to be in place. It's not something that should be optional, where you can make a decision, I'm not going to have security.
Thank you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been listening to Representative Downey and Representative Kahn talking about the silos and the different advantages to consolidation. And it's my understanding a couple years ago that Governor Pawlenty had the revenue department move to you folks and then decided not to use your services. And that concerns me that our own revenue department didn't have the trust or whatever the word you want to use, maybe you can explain it better than I, to use your services. And then, so it just concerns me as we try as the legislature, knowing that the budgets are tighter and tighter and we're trying to consolidate, that we aren't able to utilize your services.
Ms. Schlatterhoff?
I guess I was disappointed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that is true that a couple years ago, the Department of Revenue decided to utilize our data center services. At that point in time, they were relatively immature. It was like a pilot project. Hindsight, we probably should have been a little more mature in our service offering before we decided to go that direction. They, however, play a very active role in our steering team for data center services, and our data center project is one of the projects that I was just going to go into to talk about how we're moving forward to provide that service. So again, on that service as well as other all the work that we do, there are some bottom lines regarding, for example, security, where there cannot be any sort of there's far less discretion on if you're going to consume, but a lot of the services, even data center services, we have a strategy that we're approaching as an enterprise. Everyone has to go this direction. However, they're constantly, as a Department of Revenue, sharing with us, well, market is this. Can you beat this? Can you meet market price? and provide services that are consistent with our business needs, and that is the challenge that we have to deliver on as a rate-based agency.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure it was fully a market-based financial decision. It was also quality of the product. I mean, I think that was also part of the problem, wasn't it? Was it not?
Ms. Schlatteroff?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I do not disagree. That is correct.
So, I mean, we certainly have to do, Mr. Chair, excuse me, we certainly need to do well in both directions to make sure our product is good and the price is good. So, thank you.
Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Chair, committee members, on that point, one thing that's important to note is that the Revenue Department is a strategic partner with us in many different areas as well, and particularly in the security area. That's one area where we work closely with the Revenue Department. We have sophisticated sensors that are overseeing the tax systems from a security perspective. So the Revenue Department is a strategic partner of ours in many different areas.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to follow up on a question that you asked here. I mean, I'd be very interested in probably something to do in a classroom someday to figure out how you go through this price-searching process for your market services and how you go about it. But let me get to something I think was a little more fundamental and might get to where I thought Chair Lanning's question was. You're under technology services on your slide on page 3, you identify two sets, utility services and market services. My question is, how do we decide which ones go where?
Ms. Schlatteroff?
Mr. Chair, committee members, there's a formal decision-making process that we go through to define which, again, services sit in the market zone, which are utility service. It's customer-based. The way that we make a determination that something becomes a utility service is we have a whole protocol about how they get to that point. We take votes, we have a process, and then ultimately when it's declared a utility service, there's a directive that goes out either from the governor's office, from MMB, or we do it through our standards and policy.
Representative Banyan.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Schlatteroff, I'd like to know, first of all, who's on that committee, who's making those decisions. Again, it's my first year on this committee. I don't know who those folks are. Could you identify those for me?
Ms. Schlatteroff?
Mr. Chair, committee members, sure, I'd be happy to do that. Can I, let's see, I want to just go back for a minute in our presentation. So in terms of governance, so as you look at this chart, essentially, we have representation from all 23 departments of the executive branch regarding how we do our work. Again, the CIOs, all the CIOs in the executive branch sit on our all-CIO team. We also have Met Council attends the meetings from time to time, as well as MinSQ and the U has attended. And then we have a standard governance process in terms of how that evolves, where we go to something called the program review team. We have representation from, again, all 23 agencies, 9 CFOs, 9 CIOs, 9 deputy commissioners sit on that group. They then make recommendations to the commissioner's advisory board, which is representative in nature. That is 9 different commissioners that make the recommendation onto, again, the state CIO and onto the governor.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Banyan.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the explanation, and though my eyes are struggling with this this particular slide with the font size. But I'm interested in this because there are some things which are required to buy, and I work in a MinSQ institution, so I bring this up in part based on experience, that sometimes we wonder, why do we have this product? Why do we have that product? Why do we have a certain level of security? I cannot tell you how many of my colleagues are not terribly happy about having to change their password every 180 days and all the special characters that got to go into those things. Because we're not good at remembering where we are on any particular moment. I think to the extent that you can expose more things to the market process, the better it is. So I guess my question here is, how often do you review what ends up in the utility set, and how often do you look to see, is there now a product in the marketplace that wasn't there initially that we had to do ourselves, that we now think there is something that we could use that might be better or cheaper in the market?
Ms. Schlatteroff?
Mr. Chair, committee members, at this point in time, I think it would be helpful to introduce our Director of Customer Service, Tarek Tomes. He leads that effort on a monthly basis through our service strategy team to do that level of analysis, and he can share with you the process that we go through.
Mr. Tomes, please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Tarek Tomes. I am an assistant commissioner responsible for the Customer and Service Management Division within the Office of Enterprise Technology. As it relates to the question of how often that review takes place, there are a number of significant milestones. The overarching answer is continually, but there are significant milestones that trigger automatic reviews of how services are delivered and are there more effective ways of delivering those services. Probably the most common of those milestones are an additional aggregation of significant volume. When there's an opportunity to aggregate significant volume, that automatically triggers a review process on our part as it relates to how do we deliver these services and is there a more efficient, effective mannerism for delivering these services. The aggregation of volume oftentimes also coincides with a need to make sure that you expand capacity, have additional capacity. And additional capacity is typically correlated to expenditures from a capital expenditure perspective. And so that automatically reviews for us a process related to, is there a more effective mechanism from a sourcing perspective to deliver these critical services to our customers?
You may proceed with further presentation.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, so back to technology services. I want to talk a little bit about two particular services. So state IT services, we provide technology services, as we talked about before, to a number of government customers. This is the list of some of the services that we provide as a part of those services. The services that we're going to most focus today on are data center, co-location, as well as enterprise Unified Communications and Collaborations, or Enterprise Email, as a lot of people refer to that. So first, let's talk about data center services. So what is the problem? Why are we looking at the data center space in terms of a service focus? The executive branch has 36-plus data centers and 70-plus type of facilities. Some of them are closets, but we think about 36 data centers, and we're trying to get down to less than 5. The reasons why we're having that as a priority for us is, again, excessive locations, state servers, applications, requirements, those are all duplicated, too costly to maintain and operate, multiple maintenance contracts, multiple methods of doing storage, all require that we think differently about how services are currently delivered. Hard to protect hackers and disasters because it's a decentralized system, issues that Chris has to contend with his team are much more complex because there's so many locations. 3 times more square footage than required. Again, it's a waste of space as well as utilities. And built to the 40-year guidelines. Definitely the equipment is outdated. So again, complexity, maintenance, high risk, increasing costs all led to us to rethink about how we're delivering data center services today. 2 years ago, we began the process of assessing our data center environment. We contracted with a third party to do some analysis of how our environment looked today, and we found both deteriorating facilities and significant outdated equipment. Here are some examples of some of the photos that they took during their analysis. You can see a fire that was caused from some outdated equipment in November of 2009. There's an antiquated generator that's in use today, actually, from 1960s. The photo on the far side was a fire that resulted from some antiquated equipment that resulted in 24 hours of loss of service, which may not sound significant, but it was a real critical time in terms of the business need. And so it had the potential, it happened over the weekend, but it had the potential to have a very significant impact. And then on the bottom, there's just a sign that was actually posted. The water detection system hadn't been functional for a decade, and they just simply posted on the wall it wasn't working, rather than figuring out how to fix it because, again, everything was so outdated. So all the department. So what did we do? We had to come up with a solution. All of the agencies came together, and we developed agreement that we'd proceed on a co-location basis. So what is co-location? Essentially, agencies locate all of their data center services in common facilities. So they continue to provide services. They are knowledgeable about their individual business. So there's no loss of information in terms of how to do data center services. The example that was cited in terms of the Department of Revenue, this is not the same as that, in that OET isn't assuming the management of the service. Department of Revenue will still have their services. It's just that we'll be co-located, or in other words, located in the same facility. Facilities, building power, and network band is provided. Again, it's shared. We'll do the management of the service around it. For example, if there's any changes in all those other things, we are there to serve the agencies who actually provide the service, again, to their individual units of government. And then they manage their own equipment and systems or hire those from OET if they want to, but by and large, most of our agencies will just provide their services in the same place, but the same way that they provide today. This strategy provides consolidation at the lowest cost and the lowest risk to state government, which is why everyone agreed to proceed with this path. So what does our co-location plan look like? Essentially, we did an analysis of all the business applications, determined which are the highest priority, which we call those priority 1 and 2, which is 35% of all the applications, and we made agreement that they all have to move within 2 years to a common location. We also, so this defines tier 3 just a little bit in terms of those priority level applications. Priority 1 means that there's a public safety risk, and priority 2, you need recovery within 24 hours and 5 days. Again, the departments made the decision which level their applications fell in, either priority 1 or 2. And again, they have a need for tier 3, which is the highest security need for data center services. Our plan says that the tier 3, because today state government doesn't have, we're at a tier 1, and we need tier 3 services, which is an expensive level of service because of the security needs. We currently have an RFP on the street for a third party to provide those services. We can't compete within that tier. The state doesn't have the ability to compete. There would be too much dollars that would be needed to upgrade our facility to a tier 3. So we decided to look for a third party to provide that service. And we call that third party location EDC-4. For the less priority applications, again, those are priority 3 and 4, and that's a definition on the bottom of how departments went about to assess what level their applications are, priority, again, 3 or 4. Those are going to a Tier 2. So, again, highest Tier 3, that goes to a third party. Tier 2, they're going to an upgraded state facility, which we have either EDC-1, and then 2 and 3 are our backup. EDC-1 is the Anderson location, and then the backup, the secondary locations, are Freeman and Stassen. We're going to do upgrades in all three facilities eventually, over time. There's a time aspect to make sure that they are able to comply with the Tier 2 needs to be able to house the applications to the degree of security and service that they need. Where we are at today is that agencies identified their priorities in terms of the applications. We already talked about that. All of the agencies had to supply their plans about when they're going to co-locate. In other words, comply with this directive to consolidate their services by December 31st. They all submitted their plans. We're now going through the process of analyzing those plans to determine an enterprise approach to how we're going to do that. We're getting ready in terms of planning the upgrade. We're working with the Department of Administration to determine what we need for that upgrade. We're also having, again, the RFP went out November 2010. We're in the process of evaluating the responses related to the EDC-4, the third-party facility. And then we're awaiting the needs regarding our secondary facilities, EDC-2 and 3, before we proceed with planning the upgrades for those two facilities. Just want to speak one more time about the benefits of this co-location strategy. Again, it's a clear and consistent data center strategy. We identified some high-risk data centers. We made sure that they, if they didn't have the resources, that they were considered as a part of the overall plan. We are only as strong as our weakest link, so it's really important that we think about the have-nots as well as those that have in terms of how we address our strategy. So we made sure that we protect all our vital system. There's a five-year plan in place. We're addressing risk. We're making sure that we're addressing current data centers at most risk and making sure that we have the priorities based on those risk centers as well as other needs. Another way that we're reducing the cost in terms of our strategy is we're aligning moves with refresh cycles. Most information technology equipment is refreshed every 5 years. So we're saying that within your refresh cycle, where you have the new equipment delivered, just make sure, like, essentially you're changing address, and that's how we're going to reduce our move costs. And that's helpful as well. And the new equipment addresses risk too. Minimize costs. I talked already about refresh. We also made sure that we're in infrastructure investments are limited only to the facility upgrades rather than doing upgrades to all 36 locations. Again, it's just the co-location, the common facility areas. We're also working with our partners, Department of Administration, to say, okay, on the vacant space that we're all leaving behind, how can that be reutilized to be able to reduce the state's footprint to provide more opportunities for the for other relationships with people that want to be in the Capitol complex. We're also, another benefit to co-location, which is really important, is as we, in terms of the service stack, data center services are at the base. It's the power behind the plate. That's how we like to refer to it. And as we consolidate that and standardize that, there'll be a lot more opportunities for agencies to work together to reduce their costs and also do leverage buying in terms of how we explore other kinds of services, how we buy equipment, how we do maintenance contracts. All aspects of how we view the service stack will be impacted in part by if we do this data center plan.
Ms. Schlatteroff, we've got about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
It looks like you've got material going beyond 5 minutes, plus I'm sure there will be some questions from the committee. And so maybe we need to, if possible, think about having you or whoever needs to come back tomorrow or at a subsequent meeting so we could finish up this discussion. Do you have a preference? Would you be available to come back tomorrow if we need to?
Mr. Chair, if you would like us to come back tomorrow, we would be happy to do that. We were just going to transition to enterprise email, and so it would be a good time right now to just close the data center topic before we go into enterprise email, if you would like to do that.
Okay. Well, if you're able to come back tomorrow, I think that probably would be best because we don't only have a few minutes left here. Representative Downey, you had a question to this point?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to confirm my understanding of the report that I saw over the summer and the way we're actually doing these three data center or these four data centers. So the EDC-4, this big new data center, we're only doing the kind of the technical hardware side of that. The people and the services side of it is still staying in the agencies or somewhere else. We aren't outsourcing that people side of it. It's really just the technical, the wires and the servers and the physical space. Is that correct?
Ms. Schlatteroff?
Mr. Chair, committee members, that is accurate from the standpoint that data center services as a whole are not labor-intensive at all in terms of the number of FTE counts. All the agencies are continuing to provide service and making individual decisions. We are just providing the facility service, and they are doing their data center service within the facility, so that remains unchanged.
Mr. Chair, just one
follow-up. Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Schlatterhoff, then with regard to the cost, I know we went through these numbers a number of times, and pardon me for not remembering all of this, but in your budget request last year, I think there was $16 million to accomplish some of this. And then it wasn't clear whether or not there was savings to be generated from the consolidation that would actually cover the cost of this new data center. And so very briefly, and when we get to the budget hearing, I'm sure we can go deeper into this. Is this actually, you say minimize cost, but is this actually lower cost than what we're currently doing today? And just in general, how is that cost equation today versus the future under the new data center model going to play out?
Ms. Schlatterhoff.
Mr. Chair, committee members, down the road, for sure, we'll experience some reduction in cost. However, we need to make some investment in our infrastructure. Again, we're going from a Tier 1, Tier 2 currently to a Tier 3, which provides a lot more complexity in terms of security, service delivery, power cooling, those kinds of things. We largely are in retrofitted office buildings, and so the data center facility that we would obtain from a third party will provide some efficiencies down the road, but first we have to get to the level of security where we're not at risk. So that is true. We did have an initiative. As a matter of fact, it's important to note as well, and I was going to make some comments at the end, that in the governor's bonding bill that was released this week, there was $15 million regarding data center upgrades as well as decommissioning costs. So we are continuing to move forward in terms of making those upgrades and the financial needs. So the message is consistent from last year to this year in terms of the fact we need to make some capital upgrades before we experience the efficiencies down the road.
Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment, and I think it's something we're going to need to look at as we think about all of these kinds of initiatives, and the challenge always is how do we track and actually book the return on investment for these big systems projects and these other things that we're doing, and how do we actually find a way to turn this into something that's cost justifiable, especially when we consider some of Representative Banyan's comments about, you know, where and when do you actually put this out to the market and say it just doesn't make sense for the state to do it. So I think a deeper dive into this data center issue and a bill that Representative Kahn and I have to do some more consolidation in the IT space and state government, that is the lens we got to look at these things through. Where do we actually get the bang for the buck for these kinds of moves? So we'll do more later.
Thank you for being here today and willingness to come back tomorrow. And when you do come back, a question that I would like to have you respond to is how far along are we in achieving the vision that was put forward here 4 years ago? And what is it going to take from the legislature to further advance that vision as we consider what we need to do this session? So we look forward to continuing that discussion. What we're doing tomorrow, members, is finishing up the discussion from the pension funds, and then we will pick this issue back up again, Office of Enterprise Technology, and then we have Representative Kahn's bill. And members, reminder that if there are any amendments to her bill, we'd like to have those as soon as possible so that we can get them prepared and out to everyone. Would someone care to move the minutes of our February 1st meeting?
So moved.
Representative Green moves those minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Meeting adjourned.